Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 165, and we thank you for listening. James, boy, it's been a while. We've been different places, gone and offline and all that for a couple of weeks. We pre-recorded those few episodes, which people probably hopefully enjoyed, but now we're quote-unquote live again together.
Yeah, we had planned out all of these episodes so that I would have this... So that I would have this sort of week-long vacation, like a chance to essentially, but because of the timing of the vacation, it was kind of like two episodes.
Yeah.
And then we had the Corey Richards offer from Vacheron, which is very sweet, and we're super thankful, but that meant a third episode. So I ended up making four episodes in a week, which is a lift, especially with, you know, other work and everything. But I hope that everybody dug it. It was really nice to have kind of some time to not really do that much. You know, flew out to BC to visit my brother. He lives in Squamish. We just kind of laid low, walked in the mountains, watched some TV. It was a good vacation. A Squid Game came out while I was in there. Jason, I don't know if you got on the Squid Game train or not.
You
got
to tell me about that. I mean, I guess I'm good. Probably one of four people that don't know what it's about, but I keep seeing hints about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, I guess we can chat about it, because if you haven't seen it, I figure
I don't know anything about it.
The level of saturation is pretty high. It's a Korean, I think it's an 8-part or 7-part TV show drama. In which people who are in like huge amounts of debt are contacted to take part in a game.
Oh.
A little over 450 people are brought to an island.
Huh.
And they have to survive 6 games.
Huh.
And the games exist in a manner where if you fail to do this task, and they're all based on like childhood playground games from Korea.
Yeah.
And if you fail any of the tasks, you die. Or you're killed.
Oh, jeez.
And each person has a dollar value. Like, everybody has an equal dollar value for playing.
Yeah.
And when they die, their amount is given to the big pot, essentially.
Oh. Okay.
And it's a really fantastic sort of, in the same vein as if you ever saw Battle Royale, which was a pretty fantastic, but this has more of a point, more of a structure.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed by it, but obviously everybody was. I think at one point it was like the top Netflix show in 90 countries or something like that.
Wow.
So,
wow.
If you haven't seen Squid Game, I highly recommend it, as long as you're not averse to violence and you know, a pretty sort of depressing consideration of life.
Yeah.
Not through the whole film, through the whole series, but through definitely parts of it are pretty sad and kind of difficult to manage. But I mean, for me, it felt like the same sort of buzz I got from watching, you know, Parasite. It's not as good as Parasite by any stretch, but it is really good. It's well acted. It's well written. The art direction and the cinematography feels very kind of strange and interesting, especially the parts that are within the gameplay.
Yeah.
And then the character study, it takes me back to sort of my sociological years in university, you know, looking into, you know, the prison studies and the guard versus prison mentality and all that kind of stuff. And I really enjoyed it. Right. You know, I think it was a little bit too much for some of the people in our party. I found it a little too intense, wanted something a little lighter.
Yeah. Yeah.
but I ate it up and really enjoyed it. Watched, finished it once I got home, just the day I got home. And, yeah, it was good. It was nice to have something kind of exciting to watch. I feel like the last time we all did this was Tiger King. And I'll say this has a lot more merit than Tiger King. I think that's kind of where I would leave it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'll check that. It sounds intriguing. I'd have to be in the right frame of mind to watch it. You know, speaking of kind of death-defying Netflix backstabbing competitiveness, I launched into the third season of Drive to Survive last night, Formula One series.
Okay.
We talked at length about it earlier, but Gashani was working late, doing some of her day job stuff. So I had some time to kill, and I was like, I had never started the third season. I binged the first two while I was convalescing after my surgery. And so I started the third season, which is all about the 2020 Formula One season, which, you know, racing aside, it was so kind of weird to see. You know, the first couple of episodes were at the very beginning of the coronavirus pandemic and kind of how they were all coming to terms with that. And it kind of made my skin crawl to like see those early days, and kind of gave me this weird sense of dread remembering how, you know, we were all kind of wrapping our heads around you know, how to deal with it. But
I thought about this a couple times, just a little off topic from Drive to Survive. I haven't seen the third season yet. But I thought about this a couple times, like back when we had to cancel our get together, which would have been March 18th.
Yeah.
In New York City of 2020.
Right.
I remember having conversations, and I'm just thankful that it wasn't a point where we were recording an episode.
Yeah.
Where I was like, this is just a flu. Like people are really overreacting to this. This seems like not something we should be canceling hangouts because of. People should just like, you know, be careful or wash their hands. And I mean, look, you couldn't have been more wrong than I was. Goodness sakes.
Yeah.
Lucky I didn't, you know, record that in the moment. I can eat crow looking back on it, but it would have been tough to have had that as your kind of public statement. I would have been backpedaling for the last 18 months, but it's been an interesting time, and it is strange to watch anything that's been made through this. The documentary stuff is weird, but then a group of people that I really like made a movie for Netflix that I actually don't like.
Huh.
Did you see the ads for The Guilty?
Yes, I have. And I guess someone told me to watch the Danish original as well. I haven't seen either. Did you watch it?
Oh, I did watch it. I didn't realize that it was a remake.
Yeah.
But it's you know, it's Antoine Fuqua, who's known for, I mean, End of Watch with Jake Gyllenhaal, and you know, his work with
Denzel Training Washington. Day. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And the screenplay is by Nick Pizzolatto, who's the guy that did the first season of True Detective, which I think is probably the best TV ever made.
Yeah.
Everybody has their own opinion, but that's absolutely mine. That's the finest bit of TV I've ever watched.
Yeah.
So I was really excited. I'm a huge Jake Gyllenhaal fan, certainly. And he's also a producer. Ethan Hawke is in it. It's and then it was very clearly, you know, filmed during COVID. And it's sort of a bottle style film, almost like if you remember Phone Booth.
Mm, yeah.
It has a similar, but it lacks some of the same tension or theater of Phone Booth. Yeah. And in the end, I just don't think it worked out that well. I watched it, and it didn't really, I feel like it didn't engage that well. And it could be some of it was just, you know, Gyllenhaal acting to a set of big monitors.
To the
most part. And, it, you know, probably a really hard movie to make because of COVID.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so that was one that there's an example from, and that was also a Netflix one I just thought didn't work that well. How far did you get into season three of Drive to Survive?
Gosh, I think, you know, they're pretty short episodes. I realized they're less than 40 minutes, most of them. And I think I got through four or five of them.
And it's worth dipping back into. You're liking it?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It's equally good. The first episode's a little strange. You know, they canceled the Melbourne Formula One at the beginning of COVID, and then it kind of picks up from there once you get into the intrigue of drivers switching teams and all of that kind of stuff. It's a little soap opera-ish. I mean, if somebody commented on, when we were talking about it on the previous episode, someone commented on our Substack that, you know, don't take it at face value. He said it's probably a lot of kind of theater creative editing from Netflix to kind of make it more interesting. And I get that. I think sports in general, you know, high-paying sports do bring out a lot of truths about people's personalities and that sort of thing. So, it's a lot of fun. And I'm sure, you know, from the casual observations about the current Formula One season, I'm sure next year's Drive to Survive will be equally good, because it's shaping up to be a pretty interesting season with the back and forth at the top of the rankings. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is looking like a pretty interesting season this year. I've been enjoying kind of following along. I haven't been watching the races in their entirety, but it has been a more kind of dynamic season than I think we've had for the last couple years.
Yeah. And I noticed you speaking, this is turning into like a mini film and TV episode here, but I noticed in the notes here that you watched Sorcerer.
I did. Yeah. I bought a copy of Sorcerer and watched it, and like Tim could not have been more right. That's episode 161. My brother Tim came on for our film club and recommended this movie Sorcerer that I had tried to watch in the past and it didn't work out. And then I got a real copy with proper subtitles, and it's just fantastic. It's just an absolutely amazing movie. So good.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, I got to check that out.
You know, taking it a step further, you also saw a movie that we've been pretty excited about. I haven't seen No Time to Die, but you have. We haven't really talked about how to cover the new Bond movie. maybe let us know in the comments.
Yeah.
If you want a Bond episode, if you want one with a bunch of spoilers, maybe that would have to be like a surprise episode or an extra episode so that people who haven't seen it could save it for later. Let us know in the comments on Substack. We'd be happy to do something like this and even try and see if we could reach out to people from the film or maybe through Omega, and see if we could have on somebody to talk about it. But I'd be interested to see how much people want us to talk about a brand new movie. So let us know in the comments if you'd be keen on that, and we can probably look into it. But Jason, in a spoiler-free manner, because I probably won't get to see this for a few more days anyways. By the time this comes out, it'll be Thursday. I might be able to see it Sunday. It's been insanely busy, and I haven't really been leaving the house. I've just been working and trying to catch up on sleep and that kind of stuff. So where'd you stand on Bond?
Boy, it's I would say it's in my top five Bond films.
Oh, man.
It's hard in my mind to beat Casino Royale. I actually, as I look back, and I did this recently, started thinking about which was my favorite overall. And I so often my pat answer is always, the Connery films, Thunderball, Dr. No, whatever. But
right.
I don't know. Casino Royale was pretty much almost a perfect Bond film. And I was always let down by, Spectre, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall. They all had their high notes in terms of cinematography, music, theme songs, certain scenes and whatever. But this really has a real standalone, proper film with good Bond elements that will make, diehard Bond fans happy. And then there are some seriously interesting developments and twists that will shock people, I think, in the movie. And I think that's good. Hats off to them for taking some chances. And Fukunaga, we talked about True Detective earlier, and he's a great director. And I've read interviews with him and with others about the movie, and how his kind of obsession with filming at sunset caused some hurried moments and kind of complications on set when they were making the movie. But boy, it really comes out in the end. It's a tremendous film, and I need to see it a second time. I think with any of the new Bond films, there's so much anticipation. And there's just so many little nuggets to kind of capture that I need to see it a second time before I can really properly weigh in. But in a nutshell, I loved it. And I can't wait for you to see it. And then we can compare notes.
Yeah, I think I will make an exception to my, I don't really go to the theaters. Even before the pandemic, I really didn't care for the theater unless it was a movie I was really crazy about. Blade Runner is the example I've used in the past. I saw that a couple times, midnight showings where there'd be three other people in the theater.
Yeah,
I'll probably do something similar for this. Find a nice late showing and check it out. That'd be nice. Maybe I can make that happen Sunday so that we can chat about it. In some depth on the next episode, or we'll see what people say in the comments if they even want more.
Yeah,
more James Bond talk. But I mean, if it's even in loosely the same category as Casino Royale, then I'm even all the more excited for it. I think Casino Royale is one of the most complete Bond movies. If you only saw one, that's a great one.
Yeah, yep.
You could watch Casino Royale and then go all right. I mean, some of the content wasn't really for me. Maybe I'm not a Bond person, but I'm glad I picked that one.
Yeah.
It has a complete story. It has an arc. They have characters that develop. And it has all the great action and the rest of it. For me, Skyfall will always be so high on my list because of how it looks.
Yeah, yeah.
There's moments of that movie that seem kind of anemic, there wasn't a lot of development throughout the film necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be because you have in Skyfall, and this is a spoiler if you haven't seen Skyfall yet, but the proposed Bond woman really dies quite quickly in the film.
Yeah.
And it leaves this sort of vacuum in the second act that kind of, Judy Dench fills in towards the end. But in some ways, Casino Royale is more of a thriller and a Bond movie.
Mm-hmm.
With the gambling and the opening sequence in the bazaar in Madagascar, I think, and all this. And then with Skyfall, it's more of a straight down the middle action film.
Mm-hmm.
It's two guys kind of that came from the same world kind of deciding who's the strongest.
Yeah.
And it's a different energy for sure. There's just something about Deacon and Mendez working together on something like Skyfall is pretty special. So
yeah, and before we kind of move into Wrist Check and the main topic today, I do want to give a quick shout out. Since we had a couple of weeks of not recording this, I was invited to be a guest on the Spirit of Time podcast with Matt and Greg, and boy, they turned that around in a hurry. That was up the next day after we recorded, and it was a lot of fun. So, Matt and Greg, thanks for having me on. It was a good chat. As the name of the podcast suggests, you know, it's a pretty heavy kind of in watch content, but that's what you go there for. And we talked about a lot about Greg was wearing kind of a stealthy Bond watch that he didn't realize was a Bond watch. And then we talked about everything from Frank Miller to Braymont to everything in between. So it was a lot of fun. So I appreciate your having me on, guys, and check them out. Spirit of Times on, I think it's on Apple Podcasts and SoundCloud and whatever. We'll put a link in the show notes to that one.
Yeah, very cool. Glad to hear you made it on there. I can check that out. I wasn't aware of this show, but
yeah.
Oh, and lastly, I would just shout out to anyone who's in Vancouver, because I was there last week, as I mentioned. I was able to swing by the Roldorf location in Gastown. Mm. Absolutely worth your time. Got to see some Seikos I haven't seen in person ever. He's got a really good stock of like sporty Seikos, the ones that people actually want.
Yeah.
Nice to see some Braymont stuff, the Ann Ordain stuff. Sadly, I was probably a day or two too early to see their latest drop of Ann Ordain stuff, but apparently it was almost all entirely pre-sold.
Yeah.
That been a very popular brand for them, so that's pretty exciting. But the store's killer. It's in a really nice, really like interesting and good part of town. There's some great food and sightseeing to do around there. So just a heads up for anyone who maybe makes a Vancouver travel destination in the next little while, swing by Roldorf and be sure to say hi. The new store is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I saw your photos and of course I've met Jason at Hodinkee 10 event and know him, you know, well through your associations when you lived in Vancouver. And, you know, Jason's an interesting guy anyway. He's a Brit with a Defender and he's a very accomplished technical diver and a watchmaker. And then the brands that Roldorf carries, you know, I'd love to have a shop like that in town. I mean, they carry Nomos and Braymont and
Nomos, Zin,
Laco.
It's like, yeah, Braymont, Seiko.
That's like a legitimate reason to cross the border and like make an actual
watch
pilgrimage.
They do a lot of
pilgrimage.
Yeah, for sure. And they do a lot of the assembly for Halios.
Yeah, so cool.
You know, when they need help with putting the watches together. So yeah, it's a great shop with a really killer lineup. They carry a lot of good brands and nice people, and it's a nice part of town. You can sit and like enjoy some space there, and then there's like five or six amazing places to get lunch. Wow. Right nearby.
Wow, so cool.
So yeah, just another one of the many treats that are that await anyone who heads out to the perfect city of Vancouver. Yeah. How about some wrist check?
I'm still wearing my Seamaster, the white dialed Seamaster Pro. I mean, it's I've changed it a few times for a day or two here and there in the past couple of weeks, but it remains firmly on my wrist, and I've been having fun with strap changes. You know, today I've got it on the Artem sailcloth with the gray stitch and the fold over clasp. So, you know, Artem was kind enough to, I had bought an Artem sailcloth strap a while back, and then they reached out and asked if you'd be interested in checking one out and if I'd like to try out one of their fold over clasps. And so they were kind enough to send us each some samples, and I moved the Omega onto one with the fold over clasp. And, you know, not just saying this because they gave us these samples, but these are just tremendously good straps. My only quibble would be I really want other colors.
Yeah.
But, you know, what do you think? I mean, I think they look good on so many watches.
Yeah, it's a largely similar story with me. I'm wearing my Braymont S302. I've only taken it off to take some photos of the Vostok, which the review will be live the day before this goes up. So if you want to read about the Vostok Amphibian, I had said on a previous episode it was a 420.959. It's a 420.380. It just took me a little while to figure it out. I did buy a 420.959, but as these things go, what I received was a 420.380, which is a Scuba Dude version of a very similar overall thing. Anyways, that's not that important, as I'm wearing my Braymont S302. I've had it on every day, all day. It was the only thing I wore through vacation. So since I got it, it's pushing up on about 2 weeks now. That I've had it on. I absolutely adore it. And I came home from traveling, and I had this package from Artem. And to be honest, like, I don't wear black straps.
Yeah.
Almost ever.
Yeah.
I have a couple black rubber straps, like a black Tropic. I don't mind. I have a nice like Hirsch Pure in black, which I like as well. And I got this, and sailcloth for me, it's all a question of how easily it eventually molds to your wrist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you have to deal with that span of time where the the durability of the strap makes it kind of rigid.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not always comfortable. Sometimes I have a bony wrist, and sometimes it kind of pinches the flanks, the outer edge.
Yeah.
You know, with this one, it took maybe a half hour to settle in a little bit on my wrist. And now after, say, 4 or 5 days,
yeah,
I find it quite comfortable. I really like this fully spring-loaded sort of double butterfly fold-over that they've got on it. It's like very secure and strong and has a clip in it.
Yeah,
but is easy to take on and off. This is a black 20 millimeter with the gray stitches, similar to what you had mentioned you've got on there. And yeah, like you, I think the only thing I would change is I'd love to see it in gray, obviously.
Yeah.
Like I think it would just be, if they only do one other color, I'd love to see a gray one.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe that's something that we could, who knows, maybe we could kind of make something with them.
Yeah,
in the future, as we know our way around a gray strap here there, but otherwise, I mean, color aside, and that's so personal. Most people adore black straps, so this isn't like a normal opinion that's worth carrying on.
Yeah,
I really like this strap. It's really well made. I would say it's very close to any other like OEM sailcloth I've ever come across.
Yeah,
and of course, what it might lack over a $700 or $800 option from who knows. IWC or Omega, I guess.
Yeah.
This is $85 with a buckle.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I'm really impressed by it. They make a nice thing. It looks really good on the watch. It's definitely comfortable. I could see it being a really good summer strap because, of course, you can get it wet. You can really kind of, you know, get it sweaty and all that kind of stuff. So I would say for the money, they seem to have made a good strap. So it can be hard to find what feels like a high-end strap for under $100.
Yeah.
And I think they've done a nice job with it. So I would say kudos to Artem on the sailcloth strap. And yeah, reach out if you want to talk about other colors. Not that they need our help, but a gray one would be rad.
You know, I had initially bought one for my Blancpain because it actually comes on a sailcloth, but it was always too short for me. And I tried to punch a new hole and that didn't go all that well and whatever. And so when I looked into it, somebody had written in, one of our listeners, and said, oh, you should try Artem. So, you know, thanks to our listener who suggested Artem way back when, but that kind of turned me onto them. But I have to wonder, you know, sometimes like a strap like this will sort of fade out or discolor a little bit. Maybe that'll happen if we wear them enough. Maybe it'll kind of bleach out a little bit from salt, sweat, sun, water, et cetera.
One can only hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look good. But yeah, solid straps. I love the Omega. I love seeing the pictures of it. And I'm just obsessed with this S302. I simply adore it.
Yeah.
Such a nice watch. I love that it's a chunky enough, like tough dive watch that I can sleep with.
Oh yeah.
Like I could just have it on my wrist. I don't have to take it off.
Yeah.
It's good on a NATO. It's incredible on like a light leather strap.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of getting used to the sailcloth, which is kind of a different thing altogether.
One day I'll rant about people complaining about divers on leather straps, but I'll withhold that for now. But that is one diver that does look really good.
That's been a thing as long as I've been in to watches.
Yeah.
People telling me that I shouldn't, and I just don't get it.
I don't either. I don't get it. But that is one that looks tremendous on leather.
If you're about to go diving, yeah, I agree.
Right.
But like, it's right. Real easy to change watch straps.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. I can put it on something else before I go diving. Don't worry.
Yeah.
I don't just suddenly find myself scuba diving. Like if I plan to go out for a coffee with somebody, I don't usually end up also just underwater.
Yeah, right.
So I think it'll be okay. Like if the consideration is like, it's like you shouldn't put street tires on an SUV.
Yeah, yeah.
I drive it on the street.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll put winter tires on it when winter gets here.
Yeah.
Who cares? What a weird thing
that it is like very...
some strap shouldn't be on some watch.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Leather on a diver's fine, for goodness sakes.
Yeah. No rubber on chronographs, you know, heaven forbid.
how would we all survive?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, with wrist check out of the way, I think it's time for some main topic. We've got a kind of fun one because while I was hanging out in BC looking at mountains and laying on a couch a lot, you went out and did an off-roading course that we've talked about a few times on the show, but now we get to actually hear how it went.
Yeah, finally.
So this is through Iron Range Off-Road. And why don't we start with like the basics, maybe what it costs and what you need if you wanted to take part in it.
Yeah, so this course is offered, as you mentioned, by Iron Range Off-Road, which is a private company. It was started by a guy named Mark, who lives, he used to be local to the Twin Cities. He's since moved somewhere up onto Lake Superior and started this business. I think he said, I think he said 20 years ago. So he's a pretty avid off-roader, and just kind of saw a need for instructing people that you know have Jeeps mainly, but basically any 4x4 that you want to get a little bit more comfortable with off the beaten path, so to speak. And so he started this class. It cost $399 for a 2-day class, and he holds these classes up at the Iron Range Off Highway Vehicle Park. And this is it's a dedicated, gosh, I think they said 160-acre area of the Iron Range in northern Minnesota, which is where they used to mine for iron ore. And it's kind of this heavily forested, rocky, hilly part of the state, kind of perfect for this. And I think there were about a dozen vehicles, and I think that's about his max. He said that was a big class, and it's over 2 days. So you kind of book your own lodging and go up there and then you meet for, it's not quite 2 full days. It's about a full day and about a half a day. And he calls it, distinctly, like, this is not for extremists. This is for beginners, people that just want to get comfortable with their vehicle. The only requirement really is that you have a proper 4-wheel drive vehicle. So, taking our Volvo XC60 with all-wheel drive would not have cut it. You need something that has low range, 4-wheel drive.
Some ground clearance.
Some ground clearance is kind of the only requirement. So, as you might expect, by and large, our class was made up of Jeep Wranglers, mainly modern ones, I'd say, within the past 5 years. And yeah. There were only two outliers. There was us with our 1993 Defender. And then there was another guy and his wife who came with a Toyota Tacoma TRD pickup truck.
And a modern one?
Modern one, yeah. I think he was brand new, actually. I think he'd just gotten it within the past year. And So that's what it took, and it was great. Mark he's a fantastic instructor. I wasn't sure what to expect going into this. I thought, off-roading is one of those pastimes that kind of runs the gamut in terms of the types of people and the ambitions and expectations that people have. And I didn't want to get into a course with a lot of big, mutters or guys that just want to go wheeling and bash up their vehicles and whatever. And it turned out to be a really pleasant group of folks that really just wanted to learn how to do this kind of thing safely. And so, we just had really good fun. There were certainly some scary moments, some anxious moments. I had gone into this without really any off-road experience. I had been a passenger off-road a few times, and I had taken, the Defender and some past vehicles on kind of fire roads or forest roads. But nothing right. to this extent. It was great. And, one of the other guys in the class, this is funny. We broke for lunch both days. So you had to pack a lunch. We just made some sandwiches and a flask of tea and brought it along. And then we would take a break halfway through. And I was sitting at a table with a guy who had a white dial, Explorer 2 on like yours. And turns out his name's Peter, and he's he's a TGN listener. Yeah, which is what are the odds, now I've met
that's crazy
TGN listeners in the strangest places, but the North Woods of Minnesota at a 4x4 class was a new one, and he was there with Alyssa, and he had a Rubicon Wrangler, beautiful truck, and he said he was a TGN listener, and he said his Polar Explorer may or may not have been influenced by you with yours, so yeah, Peter, if you're listening to this episode, it was great meeting you. And we were divided into two groups. The way that the class had split up, Mark, the founder of the group, had I think two or three other instructors working with him, and they split our group into two groups of about 6 or 7 trucks each. And the one group was the Rubicon group, and I'll explain this in a second. And then the other group was the rest of us, and Peter, this TGN listener, was in the other group because he had a Rubicon. And the reason Mark split it up that way is because if you're not familiar with Jeep's lexicon, and James, I know you are, the Rubicon is a more extremely off-road oriented vehicle that has locking differentials front and rear, so that you can lock left and right side wheels at front and back together, which makes it a more capable off-road vehicle because it won't spin a wheel that is on slippery terrain. So our group was the non-Rubicon group. So it was the the other Jeeps. It was the Saharas and the, I guess, kind of the base model Wranglers. And so the even though the Tacoma has locking differentials, the TRD version, which is a pretty cool truck, actually. it still had lower ground clearance and a less experienced driver. So he was with our group. And then Mark himself was actually driving, and this is the coolest vehicle of all. It was a 1981 Jeep CJ8 Scrambler. And he'd had this truck for many years. It was a 4-speed stick shift. He had a locking differential only on the rear. And he had, you know, no roof, no doors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said he's replaced the chassis like 2 or 3 times. And the tub was a custom fiberglass, actually body that he had swapped years ago with a straight six, motor in it. Just a beautiful old battered old truck, but
it's super cool.
But he was with our group, and I think it's because, you know, he, given his vehicle, he on paper at least would not have been able to keep up with a Rubicon. And so our group with the sort of the lesser outfitted trucks went with him. It was some measure of comfort to me because when he asked us at the beginning who all here is driving a stick shift, mine was the only hand that went up, and then of course him with his old Jeep. And so it was nice to have somebody that could at least commiserate with, you know, with a stick shift older vehicle like our Defender.
Yeah, that's fun. With the lockers, it is an interesting thing. And if you're listening and you don't know what a locking differential is, so differential is decides which wheel gets power. And typically cars have normal vehicles have an open differential, so the most power coming out of the transmission and going to the wheels will go to the wheel with the least resistance. But if you're off-roading, that's a big problem because you could have a wheel in the air. You could have a wheel that's slipping on rocks, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea is if you have a locking differential, what it's going to do is it's going to lock the driveline together so that the wheels rotate at the same speed. So you'll see some vehicles have locking differentials under certain scenarios. Some vehicles have e-lockers, which is an electronic differential. And some vehicles kind of have a mix of that. The gold standard in many ways is the G-Wagon, which has, you know, independently controlled three-way lockers. So front, back, and down the middle. And it just gives you more flexibility to decide how your wheels are managing the power. And you get a lot of the same things from in higher end sports cars. They're just put to different use. They're typically, you know, to keep the axle spinning at the same speed.
Yeah.
And it can change the way that a car handles or operates. But for off-roading, it's really considered to be essential, especially in terms of the rear axle if it's a rear wheel drive vehicle. And there's certain considerations in which you want the ability to have it unlocked or locked, right?
Yeah.
Turning circles, things like that. But that would be why that's kind of crucial to off-road driving, and a lot of different manufacturers handle that in different ways.
Yeah, and it was interesting to kind of see that in practice. The Defender, you know, all old Land Rovers did not have front and rear locking differentials. They do have a center locking differential, which is controlled by a lever in the cockpit there. You know, driver ability does, you know, and I suppose other factors come into play as well. And so, I mean, it's not to say that without the lockers, you can't get through things. And the Defender certainly was plenty capable for everything that we did. And I was quite happy with it and pleasantly surprised. But it did make sense for the group to kind of split up along those lines. And you know, you could see, and Gashani has put up, she edited together a nice video of our experience. And it was in an Instagram story. And we can link to that, but you can see some situations where, particularly when we were doing a rock crawling segment, where you can actually see the front right wheel of the Defender kind of spinning in air, trying to kind of grab something and kind of spinning freely while the left wheel was not turning at all. That's because the front differential being an open differential. But the other added challenge was this idea of having a manual gearbox, because it does have some advantages, but there was one sort of situation where we were practicing hill ascents and descents. And one thing that Mark had told us to do is that, you know, if you get committed up a very steep hill and you realize either you can't make it or you've encountered an obstacle or you need to take a different line, you should know how to safely back down the hill, because if you just mash the brakes, you're going to, you know, slide sideways. You could roll the vehicle, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you get halfway, three quarters of the way up a very steep hill, you should be able to put it into reverse and back down. And keep in mind, you're in four wheel low. So the engine compression is actually what kind of slows the vehicle, not the brakes. You should be able to put it in reverse and go back down, and then even restart on a hill, you know, stop halfway up and then get going again based on just tire grip and low range gearing. Well, you know, anyone who's driven a stick shift knows that even on a steep city street, it can be a challenge to kind of get going again without the vehicle rolling backwards. And so we did this exercise where we were doing these hill climbs, and then he said, you know, okay, I want you to stop halfway up and then kind of get going again. I want to demonstrate to you that your vehicle can do this. Well, I think he had forgotten that I was in a stick shift. And so I stopped halfway up, you know, must've been like a 30 degree incline. And and then he's like, okay, you know, now come back to the top. And I was like shaking my head like, ugh. And, you know, I mean, I've driven stick shift since the mid 80s. So I'm pretty good at it. And I just kind of did it quickly and got it going again. And, you know, certainly all the tires spun and grabbed and I didn't roll back too much and made it to the top. But when you're doing like rock crawls where like you get bashed up against kind of a boulder or something and you want to kind of creep over it, The modern Jeeps with automatics, some of them have, you know, a crawl feature or hill descent or, you know, these features that will just allow the vehicle where you can just sort of take your foot off the brake and it will just very slowly kind of creep over without rolling backwards at all. Well, you know, I don't have that option. So you spend a lot of time kind of feathering the clutch, or timing your approach. Momentum is very key with an older stick shift truck like this to kind of keep going up a hill while you're also trying to find the correct line to take over and around rocks. And but I was pleasantly surprised. I was able to do it. There was one particularly big rocky climb that I thought I saw it from the bottom. It was very daunting. And you know, we'd heard that even Rubicons and the other group were getting hung up and stuck in the mud and ruts and on rocks. And so I thought, okay, this is going to be a challenge. And a couple of the vehicles went first, and Mark and his other instructor, Jim, were up ahead of us, kind of spotting for people, pointing out which way to go, which rocks to avoid or which rocks to crawl over. And a couple of the other vehicles had difficulty. The Tacoma really, really struggled, despite the lockers, you know, it just didn't have the greatest ground clearance. And then he had kind of road tires on as well. And so when it was my turn, I kind of picked a line and just had it in four wheel low first gear. And I just kind of, I don't want to say cruised to the top, but, managed to kind of dance my way around the rocks and get all the way to the top. And it was really satisfying. It was a very empowering kind of experience to have moments like that. Even the rock crawling was cringeworthy. You know, you hear something scrape or bash or for sure, you know, whatever, or you get stuck and it's like that's what it's all about. It sounds a bit goofy and cliche, but you know, it's kind of a team sport. You know, Gashani was doing a lot of the spotting, pointing out, you know, which way to go. She had to be my eyes and kind of look underneath to make sure I wasn't going to bash my differential or any of the steering rods on rocks. In that way, I mean, you learn about the capabilities of your vehicle. And I just found that the Defender's way more capable than I'll ever be. I mean, this is a legendary kind of Camel Trophy, Darien Gap kind of truck. And I'm just this novice city dweller. But it did okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm glad that it worked out well. I mean, I guess I kind of expected as such. I mean, maybe the holdback for the Tacoma is, you know, the locker in that is only rear, I believe, and it's electric.
Oh, okay.
It could be something that's changed, or you can upgrade it from the factory. But in my understanding, for four-wheel drive tacos, the rear is a locker, then there's a center limited slip differential.
Okay.
But then with an E locker, it's not mechanical. That's the E part, right? Oh, so they're using something to retard the wheel less grip, usually the brakes. But again, I don't know the specifics of the Toyota system. If you're a Tacoma driver and I'm getting this wrong, one, it's probably not super important to the conversation, but two, I'm doing my best. In my experience with Donut just built out two Tacomas from a previous generation.
Yeah.
And one of those had an E-locker. It's built into the rear axle. And then to go a step, if you want to go a step beyond that, they installed like ARB pneumatic lockers, like hydraulics.
Yeah.
And
I think with bigger tires and ground clearance, this guy would have done a lot better too.
Tires make a huge difference for sure.
Yeah.
It's funny with the manual thing, because I was kind of hoping that you'd have at least a couple of the other Jeeps there.
Yeah.
Would have been one of these unicorns that buys a JL with the stick.
Right.
Jeep has made it so they really don't seem to want people to buy the stick. I mean, I think the take rate's less than 4%.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then I believe, and again, this could change where you live. It could be different, but at least in Canada, and I think in the States, you can only get the 6-speed manual on either the kind of, not the base gas engine, but the least interesting engine, the 6-cylinder, and or the diesel. And the diesel with the stick is probably an absolutely incredible thing to drive off-road.
Yeah.
But I think most people, it seems they're going with the automatic. And I, you know, if you're rock crawling and you just want to be out there and enjoy yourself, it makes sense to go with the automatic. Like, I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Only buy the manual if you think it's going to be more fun, because that's the only scenario in which you'll be right.
Right.
The rest of the time, like, automatics have just gotten so good
and
capable and strong and the rest of it. But
yeah,
it's exciting, you know, because I've done a couple like little off-roady roads around Toronto, unassumed roads, rutted out off-road roads, but nothing with like the crawling or the really steep stuff.
Yeah.
And it's fun that you had to sit at the bottom of a hill and look up and be like, I don't know about this. I remember I went on the press launch for the current generation Range Rover Evoque.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah.
And when we were there, it was in London, they had set up like this course.
Hmm.
In what was kind of, I think, an abandoned train yard somewhere in central London or nearly central London.
Yeah.
So they had this whole course, and it was wood that you're driving on, kind of like those ramp walls that you see for single track mountain biking.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Those big steep things that you're meant to rip across.
Yeah.
And there was a guy standing in front of you doing the hand signals.
Yeah.
They had a radio in the door in case you really messed it up. And you basically just had to very slowly crawl along. And let's face it, like the Evoque, especially if you put some tires on it, like any modern Land Rover or Range Rover is a seriously capable vehicle.
Yeah.
It mostly comes down to tires and ride height. And the Evoque kind of has both. It's not a rock crawler, but it was more than comfortable. Like we drove it through a pool, like very deep water.
Yeah.
And up and down these weird ramps, and then up these. But the one that got me the worst was that it was like a certain degree of like leaning to the side.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was passenger wheel up.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just driving. I'm like, I'm gonna roll it. It's somebody else's car. I'm gonna roll it.
Yeah.
It's gonna go over.
Yeah.
And then like we finished it, and the guy was like, "Hold, wait here. You know, the next car is not moving as quickly." So I had my window down. I was chatting with him. I was like, how much steeper would that have to be to roll it? He's like, a lot. You're not even close. Like we pick enough incline that it makes people feel scared if they don't know what they're doing. I was like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. That was scary.
there was a trail system that we did on the second day called On the Edge. And it was aptly named because it was a trail that was, gosh, maybe 2 feet wider than the Defender. And on one side on the right side of the vehicle was a sheer drop into a ravine with a lot of big boulders at the bottom. And then the left side was the hill coming down quite steep on that side. And so there was really no room other than the width of the vehicle. And before we set off on it, Mark said, you know, what you don't want to do here is get too far to the left, compensating for that drop, because then you'll start to get further and further up the slope with your left tire and the vehicle will potentially roll. And, it was a little daunting. You know, I was, of course, the only one in a right-hand drive vehicle. And so I was on the ravine side. So I was actually, it was kind of an advantage because I was able to kind of peer out the window and see just how much room I had. But it also gave me a view right down into the ravine. So it was a little spooky. And we all had radios, you know, just two-way radios that were clipped onto the visor. And at one point somebody said, okay, stop, you know, we got a problem. And so we all kind of stopped in a line and I walked back to two Jeeps behind me. And another student in a Wrangler had really gone up the side of the incline and was at a, I don't know if all Wranglers have this as a feature or if it was something aftermarket, but it was the angle. It told the pitch or the roll or angle.
Like an inclinometer or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. And it was, I think she said it was a 34 degree angle that she was hung up on a rock. She had gone too close to the embankment on the left side. And okay. there she was with in the driver's seat, and her passenger, you know, poor passenger, was like looking down at this ravine. And it was a pretty precarious angle. And everybody was like, okay, this is kind of serious. And Mark and Jim, the two instructors, very quickly, you know, said, okay, roll down the driver window. We're going to, you know, put a tow rope around a tree up the slope, put it on one of your recovery points, and then slowly winch it with Jim's Jeep behind to, while you reverse off this slope slowly. And so we all kind of watched while this happened, and, you know, it was one of those like mildly like scary situations where you kind of see what could happen if you do things wrong. And then mm-hmm. the other group, in the Rubicon, someone actually rolled one of their Wranglers, and it was a Wrangler with a soft top, and it kind of crushed in the rear. All it did was actually damage the rear frame of the soft top at the back. And then something wow. about rolling it on its side, they had to crawl out the roof, and then they righted it and were able to finish, but it was kind of pouring smoke.
That's gnarly.
But you know, this is not to say that this class is death defying. You can certainly opt out of anything you want, and everybody kind of emerged unscathed and still smiling and happy. But you know, it was kind of a little window into, you know, how serious this kind of thing can be. So I didn't have any lasting damage on the Defender, fortunately, despite the kind of clunks that I was hearing when I was doing the rock crawl. I did manage the trailer hitch is kind of a weak spot. It's kind of a low point on this, unfortunately. And it had these built-in kind of aftermarket steps so you could climb into the back more easily. And that got bent up. And then there's like these two small bumperettes on each rear corner that got bent, but I just had to kind of kick them back into proper orientation after the fact, and they were all fine. But other than that, it did okay.
So when you're doing this, is it kind of like the lead car is the first one going along, and then someone gets out and they do the hand signal thing, or is it all on the radio? How's it work?
Yeah, so Mark was in the front of our group, and then, you know, five or six of us, and then Jim, the other instructor, was at the back, and he had like a 99 Jeep. I don't know if that's a TJ, but that he'd done some modifications to over the year, but a pretty basic Jeep. But he also took a lot of the photos, and he did a nice job of that. But he was a good calming presence, doing follow up, and then we all had radios in our vehicles. So Mark would say, okay, coming up here, there's a bit of a tricky section, try to stay to the left, whatever. But then Mark would kind of navigate a section, and then he would park, and then he would come back and kind of spot for us. And then along the way, you know, I mean, you're going so slowly. I mean, I never got out of first gear the whole weekend. Gashani would jump out and kind of direct me around rocks or through water or whatever it was. So yeah, nice. The instructors kind of flanked the group or bookended us as we were moving through, and they did a really nice job. And, you know, I would say, you know, it's funny because at the end of all this, Mark handed us all a bunch of like these postcards and kind of ads for his business. And he's like, you know, if you're ever at the grocery store and you like park next to kind of a cool Jeep, like stick one of these under the windshield wiper. Like a lot of people have Jeeps or Land Rovers or you know, Land Cruisers or whatever, that like want to do something a little more ambitious. Like they want to get out of the parking lot, out of the, you know, the city streets, but they're a little intimidated. I mean, that's exactly how I was. And I would absolutely 100% recommend something like this. If you're in the Midwest, this Iron Range Off-Road Park is kind of the premier location in this area. But, you know, certainly out west, you're going to find all sorts of stuff like this. But
yeah,
I can't recommend it highly enough. And I actually want to go back next year sometime and you know, put together a little group of friends. You know, Mark will do private classes, and you know, I even thought, you know, it'd be fun to do like a TGN thing or something. I mean, just
super fun.
Get some folks to kind of road trip there. We ended up staying, we rented like a condo at an off-season ski resort place that was a pretty mm-hmm. quiet and pleasant place to be. It was about 15 minutes from the off-road park, and it was just a blast. It was just so much fun. Like it really,
I'm,
you know,
glad to hear it.
Sitting in the vehicle for 8 hours, you wouldn't think would be exhausting, but I mean, I'd go to bed that middle night, you know, that Saturday night, like just worn out from, but still kind of jacked up from the adrenaline. I mean, it was proper fun. It was really good. One little tip that we did take away from this, and you know, I've heard of this before, but I'd never actually seen it in action, was Mark and a couple of the other instructors in the group for the lunch break. They'd strapped food onto the exhaust manifolds of their vehicles all morning while they were driving around. They called it manifold meat, but one guy actually zip tied a can of, you know, Chef Boyardee soup SpaghettiOs or something to the exhaust manifold of his Jeep. And then at lunchtime, you just snip it off, open the can, and you've got like piping hot soup. Or Mark had done like smoked pork shoulder or something like that he wrapped tightly in tinfoil and lashed that onto his exhaust manifold and then just put it into like tortillas at lunch and had a hot meal. I mean, Gashani was just blown away. She's like, oh, when do we go camping next? We're definitely going to do that. And it's a cool idea. So
I always got a laugh on Top Gear. They would do that, but half the time they would just put like a piece of bacon on the engine and then they'd be like, you know, this doesn't taste great.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the key is to seal it up from any, spatter and whatever else.
A great car is going to be dirty after a few miles when it comes to what's on the engine, but that's super fun. It sounds like a real blast. You know, I've had some experience doing that both at a paid level and at like a press level in terms of like driver instruction courses.
Yeah,
and not a ton of off-road. And they had an off-road rally course set up when I went on the Lamborghini Urus launch. So they allowed you to do 2 laps kind of in anger, but it was a single track. It was just as wide as the Urus, which is a big vehicle. If you imagine like driving a really big Subaru, like STI, that's kind of how this feels. Like triple the power.
Yeah.
So that was fun and kind of scary. And they definitely had it designed so there wasn't any actual technical challenge. You just kind of powered out of everything in the all wheel drive.
Yeah.
But a lot of that stuff is when it comes down to like when you're learning, I think that adds a lot of it. It's one thing to find a road and go for a drive, but the whole time you're kind of hoping like, oh, I hope I don't snap a control arm and then I'm stranded out here.
Right.
I don't know if CAA or AAA is going to drive down an off-road road to come get me.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But to do it in a course where, when you do put your wheel in the wrong place and you might roll your vehicle, someone's there to figure out how to do the recovery safely and that kind of thing. I can't support this enough. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great way to experience a vehicle. Like a lot of people these days own SUVs, and to your point, you know, it's more about the space and the comfort of winter driving and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of these can do some stuff off road, and you get out into nature. And I don't think it has to be rock crawling. Like I've driven down some unassumed roads that are really lovely.
Yeah.
And I would say that the challenge for the most part is finding a place where you can do it, where you're not like, am I maybe trespassing? Is someone about to get really angry?
Right. Yeah,
because that's always my concern. I'll drive around even the area up by my cottage, and I'll see roads that are marked as unassumed by Google. But then, you know, they have no trespassing, and then you look up the municipality, and you're like, "Well, the road's mostly on, you know, public land.
Yeah,
so I should be able to drive on it." But you don't know if the person who maybe lives at the other end of the road or off an offshoot of the road feels the same way as you. They might not. Probably don't.
Yeah.
So I think that's some of the challenges. This is what I always liked about Venture four-wheel drive. You know, Chris Shant's YouTube channel is he uses some apps, you know, Gaia GPS and such, to make sure that he can really get around. And it seems like there's areas where there's tons of that, BLM land, etc. And there's some where there's less, and I should definitely see if there's a similar, like maybe Gaia's got the same sort of thing for Ontario. I've just never tried.
I mean, that's great. Our goal of doing this was really to get comfortable with less than comfortable travel situations. So if we do want to, you know, we've done some camping in the Defender and we want to do more of that and potentially some light overlanding stuff. And, you know, inevitably you're going to get into some, you know, rougher terrain. And even if it's just a fire road that has some washed out sections or some rocky bits or water crossings or whatever, you want to be able to know, you know, how to get out of it, what your vehicle can do and can't do and what's safe and not safe. And this was just great. And I, like you, I mean, I fully endorse stuff like this, whether it's an off-road course or, you know, winter driving class, you know, driving on ice or performance driving or track driving or anything like that. It's just fun.
Yeah. I've done Porsche and Mercedes winter driving. Porsche's is more like track driving in the winter.
Yeah,
and Mercedes is a lot more about car control. It's on a frozen ice. It's on a frozen lake in Manitoba.
Yeah,
both are incredible. I highly recommend either. When I was younger, I went through 3, maybe now it's 2, but at the time I think it was 3 courses, maybe 4 days total over the course of the while of the BMW Performance Driver sort of program.
Yeah.
And so that starts with like a half day. You sit in a class for an hour and then you go out and you do some skid pad stuff, kind of get an idea for car control, and then it accelerates from there.
Yeah.
And I never got to the part, you know, eventually you can apply for your race license. You can go do like a weekend at Mont Tremblant with open track driving and that kind of thing. And I'm sure that's incredible. It's also just like $5,000.
Oh, yeah.
So I never got that far. I think I probably topped out wherever the course maybe was around $1,000, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed all those. So I agree. Whether you're curious about driving your vehicle off-road or you've always thought like, hey, I'm a capable driver. I'd love to see how I fare on a track. All this kind of stuff with an instructor, whether it's a radio or right seat, is very valuable. I think It's super worth it. It's going to increase your confidence behind the wheel, especially in bad scenarios.
Yeah,
which is when you need it the most. I think this is super, and I'm thrilled you had a good time. And I'm not at all surprised that the Defender was more than capable of it. But glad there wasn't any damage or anything like that, which can happen at these things, like you said with the rollover.
Yeah, cool. So you know. Hats off. Thanks to Mark and Iron Range Off-Road. And you know, certainly if anyone has any specific questions or comments about your own off-roading experience or about this class in particular, drop them in the comments under the notes for the episode.
Absolutely. You want to get to final notes?
Yeah, let's do it. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, I'm happy to go first. So mine this week is actually one that, Jason, you sent to me. I haven't really been up to that much. We already talked about Squid Game, which was possibly the only other thing that would have kind of worked here. But this is an Instagram page and a website called JE Brickworks. So on Instagram, it's JE_Brickworks. And it's essentially Lego sets, both complete sets or just instructions, that will allow you to build a range of cars. So they're smaller cars, closer to what we've seen with like the Speed Champion stuff I've talked about before.
Yeah.
So you're not talking about these giant things that are going to take hours. The idea is they're more in line with a small model in terms of size.
Oh, sure.
And you know, they're $20, $30,
$40.
Yeah. For the most part, completed kits, would include things like he's got this incredible Datsun 240Z.
I'm looking at that
like
now.
A vintage one.
So cool.
I think the Countach looks incredible in Lego. It's all hard angles and straight lines, so that it works beautifully.
Yeah.
Weirdly, he's made a beautiful Mira, which I'm going to have to buy. All of these ones, it's the kit with the instructions, is 35 pounds.
Yeah.
So it's more money than a Speed Champions, but it's a different sort of thing. And I would say they're almost all of them, if not all of them, are better executed designs of the original car than the Speed Champions are.
Huh.
Not, or at least equal to.
Yeah.
Like the 308 looks incredible. I have the S1 Quattro from Speed Champions, and he has a Quattro Group B kit car here. Really fun, really cool SL300, a killer Toyota 2000 GT, not a common car, you know, a really, really cool collector car. I'm really thrilled by this. And then if you don't have any interest in buying and building a little Lego kit, go to the website or the Instagram and just look at the instructions, because each one has a photo of what he's built.
Yeah.
And it's like some really cool stuff. There's a Giulia GTA. There's a Defender, a blue long body two-door Defender, old like a Series 3, I guess.
Yeah.
Cayman GT4, 930 Turbo, VW Transporter. A really cool, the two-door Range Rover Series 1s, a 1970s Range Rover.
Yeah.
I really like this. This is super fun. They're really cute. There's like a really awesome Volvo wagon with like a roof rack. Yeah, I could see this. You know, the instructions are something like 7.5 pounds,
yeah,
which seems fair. And then in the little about section here, it's saying that you can use a service called BrickLink, which I guess is where you order raw Lego, and it's this self-populated list.
Oh,
so you can get all the pieces
cool.
you need and then order
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So you do the instructions from him and all of the pieces from BrickLink, and you've got yourself a kit.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it's super cool. And yeah, I love this. Super, super fun.
Yeah, and I've got to give credit where credit's due. This came to me from Matt Nundorf, an old Gear Patrol buddy of mine, fellow Canadian.
Sure. Good dude.
Up on your side of the border. Matt's great, a little car and motorcycle buff. Anyway, he sent me yesterday on Instagram the blue Land Rover and said, this might interest you. And then that sent me down the rabbit hole and I sent it to you. But yeah, I mean, this stuff's so affordable and it's so cool. I think I talked about in a past episode that Histobrick, which make this niche custom Lego guy who does like Great Lakes ships and the Titanic and Britannic and some of these these custom ship models. But yeah, these are cool and so affordable. I mean, it's dangerously affordable. So yeah.
And then speaking of Titanic, did you see the new Titanic Lego?
No. Yes, I did. Yes. Yeah, that looks amazing.
9,090 pieces.
Yeah, I won't be doing that. $630
is the price I'm seeing. I think US. I'm seeing US price. So that's that's an $850 Canadian.
And kit. I think it's gigantic too. I don't think I have space.
It's got to be, let's see, dimensions, it's 54 inches long.
Okay. Yeah. That's like
18 high and 7 inches wide.
Yeah.
And it comes with like the little plinths that a boat would sit on. So you can like put it on your on a table. I guess you need a big table. 54 inches. That's goodness.
Yeah.
$630. But I know you mentioned the Titanic, and if we didn't mention this, we were going to get a lot of emails being like, "You can get a Lego Titanic."
Yeah, I
saw it. It's insanity. That's a full time job with expenses.
Yeah.
For goodness sakes.
Yeah. Right.
So funny. But yeah, so JE Brickworks, again, that's jebrickworks.com or JE_brickworks on Instagram, Jonathan Elliott. Great work, man. If we ever cross paths, I'm thrilled by these.
Yeah.
Super fun.
Yeah.
And what do you got?
Well, I've got I guess it's a two-part sort of thing, but it's a story or a video called Devil's Teeth. This is on YouTube, and it's... 10, 15 minutes long. It's some kind of archival film footage edited together with some kind of modern underwater footage of a guy named Ron Elliott, who is he's a former urchin diver. So he would kind of a commercial urchin diver in Northern California who would use a surface fed hookah system to dive in the Farallon Islands off of outside of San Francisco Bay, off the coast of California for sea urchins. And this area, if you're familiar with it, is known for a pretty high population of great white sharks, and I think it's elephant seals that seasonally roost there and swim around there, and that's what draws the great whites. And Ron is a fairly fearless guy who, during his urchin diving, took a fascination with these sharks and started making films of them, and then working with the researchers that live on the island there to research the sharks. Right. And so this video came from an article I saw in the New York Times by Bonnie Tsui, and she's a really great writer. I think I've read her work in Outside Magazine over the years, and she's written a couple of books about open water swimming. And she wrote a book about Ron and kind of his fearlessness and his interest in diving with the sharks. And then there was a link to this video. So I'm going to put in a link to this New York Times article, and hopefully you can read that without a paywall. And then also the YouTube video, which is just great. I mean, I love the kind of the quality of this video, and I think you know we certainly talk about diving enough and sharks to a certain degree, but I've long had a fascination with the Farallon Islands. I remember reading a book years ago by Susan Casey called Devil's Teeth, which is the old nickname for this set of islands, and it's just such a spooky, ominous place. Mm-hmm. And then knowing that the waters around it are populated by great whites, it's always just kind of sent a shiver up my spine. And then there's this guy who kind of has this understanding, and he's, you know, he survived an attack that almost took off his hand by a shark, but he's like, you know, we're in their territory. You respect them. He's learned, how to kind of work among them and film them. And I don't know, it's just a really interesting read in the article, and then the video is definitely worth seeing as well. This kind of murky water and these big sharks, and then this guy kind of diving among the kind of the kelp and gloomy waters out there. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I clicked on that while you were talking and just muted it. It's creepy to watch with no sound.
Yeah. Yeah,
man, the Farallons, like if you just needed in your mind to draw or imagine a place where there's great white sharks, this is it. I mean, the water's beautiful, but on the darker side, you know, dark blue, green, and then these like really kind of jagged, sparse peaks essentially coming up out of the water. And you're like, this is just a place where things are you know, gnarly.
It looks very primal. It looks like right out of, you know, like a Harry Potter or something. Like this is where the evil villain lives or something like that. Yeah, it's It's good. Yeah, it's, for sure. It's a bit spooky, but it's a good read. Good.
Very
watch.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So we'll be sure to have both of those in the show notes. And if any of you end up getting one of these kits, be sure to tag us in the photo you put on Instagram for the Lego. And yeah, try not to, if you get to the Farallon Islands, you know, stay away from the sharks if you can. As always, thanks so much for listening. You can subscribe to the show via notes.thegreynado.com or check the feed for more details and links. You can also follow us on Instagram at Jason Heaton, at J.E. Stacy, and at The Grey NATO. If you have any questions for us, please write thegreynado@gmail.com and keep sending us those voice memos. We've been getting a bunch of really good ones for the next Q&A. Finally, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcast. Music Throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Jack London, which happens to also be a subtle nod to No Time to Die for those who've seen it, who said, "The proper function of man is to live, not to exist. I shall not waste my days in trying to prolong them. I shall use my time."